You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Coming up. Coming up on the free-for-all. Bikes. Helmets. Should they be the law? But first, he's the man in charge. My boss, the boss of bosses, the most powerful man in newspapers, Wall Street Journal editor-in-chief Jerry Baker. Not talking newspapers, talking NFL football.
Timely insights, funny stories, sports, culture, life. This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
I've never heard or seen that person in my entire life at the Journal. Who is that guy, Jeff?
I have no idea. He's very talented.
It's a mesmerizing voice. This is Jason Gay, and you are listening to The Free For All, a new podcast, a new launch, a new day for the Wall Street Journal and its podcast and digital brand. Jeff Foster is my co-host today, sitting in for Jim Cherusmi. I think Jim's just lying in bed in his Mets jammies.
Yeah, he was at the game last night.
If you're listening to this, we are taping this on Tuesday. So at the moment, the Mets hold a 2-1 advantage. They are on the doorstep of the NLCS, playing tonight against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Jim's probably he's just too nervous to come in.
He's probably not home yet, to be honest.
He's still at Citi Field.
He's on the 7 train somewhere.
An incredible atmosphere to watch. I mean, that park in September is usually just tumbleweeds and a sad attitude, and just to see it rocking and rolling last night was remarkable. I am very happy about this podcast, very happy to have this opportunity, and you know me, Jeff, I like to go big or I go home, and we were thinking about guests, who would we want to have? If you could have anybody come on to this podcast for episode 1.0, who would it be?
Chase Utley.
Say that would do it.
So Chase Utley said no. But our number two ask was the boss, the editor, the man in charge, the guy in the office, Jerry Baker, editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, who is here today on the first episode of the Free For All. Mr. Baker, or may I call you Jerry?
You may call me whatever you like. I am incredibly honored to be here, Jason. It's I would have abandoned any sporting obligation I had in order to be here.
We are setting the bar high with your appearance here on the first episode of the Free For All, and I want to get right to it because Jerry, some people might not know this about him. You know, he is, of course, the most important person at the most important newspaper on the planet, but he is also quietly, or maybe not quietly, a fan of the New York Football Giants. And I don't want to embarrass you and put you on the spot, but I'd say about 3 weeks ago, I got a very pessimistic email from you, basically declaring this season kaput. And here we are, 3 weeks later, an incredible Sunday night victory later. The Giants are atop the NFC East. What happened?
Good question. They're atop the NFC East at 3-2, and behind them in a three-way tie, showing the intense competitiveness of the quality division in the National Football League this year. All the other three teams at 2-3. Yeah, look, I'm a passionate Giants fan. Despite my accent, I should explain to listeners, you can probably detect a slight Englishness there.
And I didn't even hear it.
And I have to confess, I left those shores a long time ago, and I first came to the States in the 1980s, and I became an absolutely passionate Giants fan, and I've supported them for 30 years since then. But I tend to be one of those fans. I think I consider myself a perfect New York Giants fan, actually, which is whenever they lose a game, it is the worst performance by a New York Giants team in history. They are the worst New York Giants team that's ever taken the field. They have the worst coach in football. It doesn't matter what the guy's won two Super Bowls and the quarterback's won two Super Bowls. Whenever they lose, it's a disaster. Everybody needs to be fired. So, and let's be honest, those first two games, Jason, were about as brutally disappointing and dismaying for a Giants fan as you could possibly get. Because, I mean, it's one thing to lose, and Giants fans in the last few years have got used to that. I mean, it's really, really spectacular to lose 10-point, you know, double-digit leads in the fourth quarter and stupid coaching and other decisions. And it looked like a disaster. But I accept. Once again, I've been too pessimistic. Now they are, in fact, the best team that's ever taken the field in football.
And
they are clearly going to go 14-2 right the way through the playoffs and win the Super Bowl.
Well, but don't you think this is sort of making out to be the classic Giants season, which is never 14-2? It's kind of they're scratching and crawling their way to the finish line, but they get hot when it matters, and then you don't want to face them in January. That's what happened last time.
Twice, yeah. Sorry, Jeff, go.
No, that's what happens. They have a bad run. They talk about firing Coughlin, and then they just quietly win the Super Bowl.
Usually having gone 9-7 in the regular
usually
season.
Beating the Patriots.
And so, yeah, that's right. The last certainly. I mean, it's true. Look, then they're not going to go 14-2. I can safely predict that. And will they make the playoffs? It does look right now that division. You know, I mean, plagued by injuries and
that division might just get relegated.
That could be a 7, and that could be what was it a couple of years ago? NFC South 7-9.
Last year, 7-9. Yeah, yeah.
This could be one of those seasons. And if any team can win the Super Bowl with a 7-9 regular season record, I will confidently predict it's the New York Giants.
I want to go back to something, which is just your affection for the North American football game. You know, we are constantly being told by people who come here from the continent that, you know, European football is just superior to American football. American football has no action. There are, what, 11 minutes per game? There are all these commercials. How did you find it within yourself to fall in love with this sport?
First of all, I mean, I find that sort of classic European snobbery just absolute rubbish. I mean, really. I'm an Englishman. A lot of my English friends are completely puzzled by football. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love the other football, as you know, I used to describe it. Unfortunately, I have come to term it soccer now, as you people insist. So I do love soccer. I follow it closely. I'm delighted to say, by the way, I hope you noticed another major event over the weekend was that the England soccer team completed a 100% record, 10-0 in the European Championship qualifying by beating the powerhouses of Lithuania and Estonia over the weekend. So England actually have the best qualifying record for the European Championship. So look, I bow to no one in my love of football.
I thought you were going to mention Rugby World Cup, but we're not talking
about that. Well, that wasn't so good. You know, I have to say, I'm not just saying this because England was so terrible. I've never been a big rugby fan. They made me play rugby at school. Yeah. We didn't play soccer, and I hated it. But the question about football, I think football is just the most fascinating combination of raw physical violence and extraordinary sort of strategic and tactical decision-making and planning that I've seen anywhere outside actual warfare, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it is kind of like warfare played out in a slightly less violent, more manageable way, and it's just a fast. You know, I did once write an article in a very kind of pompous and rather ridiculous way, saying it was kind of like it captured the America. I love America. I think it's a great country. I'm English. I grew up in England. I love England too, but I love America. It's a great country. It's done great things, and it is animated by great ideals. And to me, football is the classic American sport because it is that extraordinary mixture of, you know, individual, sort of rugged, tough, go and get what you want, go and, you know, and you tear other people's hearts out of their chests in order to do it, which is sort of part of the American spirit, with this extraordinary panoply and sort of network of rules and regulations and everything else. So you know, I'd once described it rather pompously as being like Hobbs and Locke, right? So, which is classic, which is America, the combination of, you know, the brutality of humanity, which is Hobbes, with the desire we have to be governed by rules and regulations and everything else. And it's great. And American football is exactly that.
Now, let me ask you this. Now, carrying this metaphor a step further, especially the warfare part, we went through this whole, almost an entire year of this controversy about deflating footballs and the New England Patriots. And, of course, those scandals go back a little bit of ways with other, you know, funny business the Patriots stand accused of. But if we are going to accept this warfare metaphor for a professional sport, espionage is one of the great classic aspects of modern, or not even modern, warfare. Why can't there be spying?
Look, the difference between the Patriots and villains in military history is that even villains in military history played by the Geneva Convention. They played by some rule. I mean, okay, not all of them, to be fair. But there was an understanding that there that war, even warfare needs to be played by some rules. The Patriots just cheat and do whatever they want to do in order to win. Now, I'm not denying that Tom Brady is a brilliant quarterback or that Belichick in his sort of evil genius way is an absolutely brilliant coach. But there's no question that they just routinely bend and break the rules.
What do you think is a harder job? Being the coach, the head coach of an NFL team, or being the editor-in-chief of a modern newspaper in 2015?
Well, I think if you go by the longevity of how the, of those positions, who survives longer, it's probably about a tie. Right? I mean...
And I do believe when you succeeded Robert as editor-in-chief of the newspaper, Marty Schottenheimer was the other candidate for the job.
It was him or Andy Reid, I think.
All right. So I'm delighted to say that Rupert Murdoch is not Daniel Snyder. Right? So he appoints people, he puts trust in them, he gives them a chance to succeed or fail, he gives them... another chance to succeed or fail, and another chance. This is a very, 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 very benign owner. Some NFL teams have less than benign owners, and I suppose it depends who owns you.
A last question for you. I know you have to get on your way. London and football. We are exporting a lot of crap football to London from the NFL.
What are we talking about? It was a great game.
That
was a terrific football game.
Shouldn't we be sending our best and brightest to Wembley?
I think we are. So there are three games this year? They're now playing three games.
Yeah, the next one is, I know the Lions have a game coming up, but the Jaguars and the Bills. The Jaguars are effectively the London Jaguars.
Right, that's right. That looks increasingly, I wouldn't say likely, but that looks increasingly possible, right? Look, the Jaguars will play in front of probably five times as many people at Wembley Stadium than they play in front of when they play at home in Jacksonville. So there's a lot of there have been some very good teams. The Giants, despite my earlier comments, have played in London. The Cowboys have played in London. I think Patriots. Did the Patriots play there last year? I mean, I think I don't think it's always the worst, and I think it's. There's a lot of travel involved. One thing I will say is those games, and I was there the weekend. It was actually the weekend of the Rugby Internationals, so that Jets Dolphins game got slightly eclipsed. But I think again they sold out the stadiums, 80,000 people. I saw a lot of people wandering around in. We've written very good articles about this,
that's
like
right.
1970s Dolphins jerseys. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of British people who still think that the Dolphins are the greatest team in football because they haven't really been paying attention for the last 40 years. But it generates a lot of interest. And I actually believe, I think an NFL franchise in London, now, maybe if it's the Jacksonville Jaguars, that wouldn't necessarily be the finest example, but maybe they'll improve. I think it would get a good following.
Do you think it's fundamentally for the NFL's purposes, they've really tapped the television market as far as they can take it domestically, that the idea of being able to secure a European team, get all those European television contracts, that's an enormous area of growth for them potentially?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they're doing this because they have some idealistic desire to, promote football around the world. I mean, I'm sure they do. I don't want to be cynical about it. But, of course, the main interest is, there's a lot of money in Europe. There's a lot of money in London in particular. There is a following for the game. As you say, there would be some television rights would become much more lucrative. I don't know what the television, whoever covers those NFL games in the UK right now, I don't know which channel it is, but there would be significantly enhanced value if there were a London team. I'm certain of that, and especially if the London team were any good. Of course, there's tremendous... And again, you can see... Look, London's a country of 60 million people. UK's a country of 60 million people. Everybody's... Soccer is still going to be the number one sport, but there's probably a million people in Britain, I would say, who either now are or potentially could become football fans, NFL fans. And that's a good enough market.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Just a last question for you. These two things happen... on one night in October or early November, you either have a major event in the presidential race, a dropout perhaps, or the Mets win the World Series. Which one goes above on the headline?
That's a difficult question. I mean, I think, I have to say we are the Wall Street Journal. We are and we do want to record extraordinary events when they happen, and when events that have earth-shattering significance are clearly going to be important. So it would be the Mets.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear.
I thought you were going to say if the Cubs won the World
Series. I was going to say we haven't talked about the Cubs. How can you be so New York centric?
I'm happy to talk about the Cubs. You want to talk about the Cubs? I believe this would be the biggest news story of the decade, were the Cubs
absolutely
to win the World
of the
Series.
Decade, the last 110 years. One of my daughters, who's a keen historian, always one of her favorite lines is that the last time the Cubs won the World Series, the Ottoman Empire was still in existence.
Wow.
Now, we are taping this on Tuesday. The Cubs play this evening against the St. Louis Cardinals. They hold a 2-1 margin. They're playing at Wrigley. An amazing piece of trivia. The Cubs have never clinched a playoff series of any kind. And then we're going back to 1907, 1908. Never done it at Wrigley.
Steve Bartman, was that? Was he
at Bartman, that was at Wrigley Field. We don't talk about that. Yeah. But the Cubs, an extraordinary tradition, and it just goes to show that the great storylines are always out there in sport, because the loyalty of that fan base and the diaspora of disappointed Cubs fans, they're coming out of the woodwork.
Cubs Mets will be a great National League champ. I mean, it won't be a great. I mean, in terms of probably quality, but it'll be just be a fantastic in terms of capturing the imagination of baseball fans and indeed sports fans anywhere. It'll be a terrific series.
I don't like to pay attention to television ratings because I don't think it's the only signifier of what the public's interests are, but it's astonishing to look at. You see Los Angeles playing New York in the playoffs last night. They get about 3 million audience. Monday Night Football, three times that.
Oh yeah.
And it's sort of an inconsequential Monday Night Football game.
Colts Texans. Yeah.
Well, we hope to have you back many times. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Pleasure.
We'll do Jeff's performance review off the air.
I thought we were going to read my performance review right now. Okay.
I need to talk to you about that, Jeff, afterwards.
Oh, okay. Fair
privately,
enough.
If that's
fair
right.
Enough.
That was Jerry Baker, editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. We give you the great guests here on the Free For All, but we'll be right back with a great story.
They're here. All new podcasts from the Wall Street Journal, including
Your Money Matters, all week long, Heard on the Street.
I'm Alex Frangos.
Hi, I'm Miriam Gottfried with Heard on the Street. Be sure to tune in to our podcast where we talk about financial issues,
the latest on global investing,
the Chinese economy,
stocks and bonds,
the biotech industry,
companies and the latest things going on
all over the world.
Your Money Matters from the Wall Street Journal. Ambition comes with earbuds. Now, timely insights, funny stories, sports, culture, life. This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Yes, this is Jason Gay. You are listening to the inaugural episode of the Free For All, a new podcast on WSJ. With me, Jeff Foster. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Jeff, do you have Jets fever 3-1?
No.
No?
No. First of all, I'm a Jets and Mets fan, so I can only...
You can only handle one Ets at a time?
I can't deal with both of these teams. when the Mets lose, I'll focus my attention there. So,
for whom is the whiff of desperation greater?
The Jets. The Jets have never won in my lifetime.
Yes. The Mets,
they did win a World
Series. This sad sack Mets thing, I think, has gone a little too far. I mentioned the fact that the Mets were in the playoffs to my wife, and she said, weren't they in the World Series in 2000? I mean, it's not ancient history. It's not like they've never been here. They've just kind of had major league screw-ups. They mess up in a massive way.
And a lot of it has to do with the Yankees, too.
Of course. They're lurking in the shadow of the triumphant Yankees.
If the Yankees were the Mariners, this wouldn't exist, this inferiority complex.
Now, the other thing I want to ask you about fever, Jeff, everything's going well for you, Jeff.
I know.
Are you playing the lottery? Okay, so the Mets are on the verge of a clinch. The Jets are 3-1, almost the class of the division behind the Patriots. And your Michigan Wolverines are what? 5-1?
That one is the one that's truly surprising.
Going into Michigan State this weekend. Oh, wait a second. Is that a game at the Big House?
It's
at
yes,
the Big
and House. They're 6.5-point favorites.
And joining us.
Good segue.
Another Wolverine. You know, this place is infested with Wolverines, like bed bugs. They're everywhere. Everywhere at the Wall Street Journal, there
True
are Wolverines. Rachel Bachman. Rachel, do you have Wolverine fever?
I have Wolverine paralysis. I'm so shocked by this. I mean, seriously, fellow fans, alumni, we're just totally stunned. I mean, we expected this, what, Jeff, like year 3 of Harbaugh? overly optimistic year two. It's crazy. It's
Do
crazy
you put this completely at the feet of Khaki's gym?
I mean, I give him the credit right now. Although I have to say the defensive coordinator, G.J. Durkin, I think that's his name, three shutouts in a row. That is astounding.
It
37
is.
Years old, three shutouts in a row. We'll be lucky to hold on to him
right.
for next year.
It really, I think it's a total testament to coach. I mean, these guys were on the team. I mean,
yes.
the talent was
this is,
there. It's
right,
the
exactly.
same guys.
Now, Saturday, though, Michigan State, number four, I believe.
They're up there, yeah.
Nationally. You know, in-state rival, not the biggest rival, which, of course, is OSU, the Ohio State. And my alma mater, University of Wisconsin. But a massive game, nevertheless. Michigan State, you know, probably dying to put some wampin' on the Wolverines. What do you think is going to happen, Rach?
I think Wolverines in a squeaker. They're not going to cover the spread. That's a little outlandish. But I don't know. This team has some mojo. It's crazy. Every week I think they can't do it again, then they do.
When do you, Jeff, start the emails, or maybe the emails have already started, with the buddies saying, hey guys, when are we going to plan a little trip back to Ann Arbor, see a game?
Oh, I think we might have missed the window this year, so I guess next. But, you know, I don't know, Rachel, if you feel the same way. I don't like being the favorites in this one. I wish our profile was a little bit lower going into this. Like, Michigan
Agreed.
State has not covered a spread this year, which means essentially that they are, you know, doing worse than everyone expected they to,
mm-hmm.
even though they've won every game. And I just don't like the way that's sort of setting them up for an underdog role.
Right. All of a sudden, we can be disappointed. I didn't think that could happen.
Yeah, I know. And then again, I can't believe I just said those last couple sentences, considering what my expectations were this year.
In the last few years, you know, there have been some real down years. What was the low of the low for Michigan fans?
I think just sort of the endless pratfall of the Brady Hoke era. It was just sort of like, can't get out of our own way. And then with athletic director, I won't even get into all that stuff, but giving away tickets for, what is it, buying Cokes or something? I mean, that to me was the ultimate devaluation of the program.
Jeff?
Oh, I can't even begin to name them. The incident with the Shane Morris and bringing mm-hmm. the guy who had the concussion back on the field, that was pretty low. But, I mean, one of countless horrible, boring losses was probably also up there.
But now you guys are just blossoming like crocuses all around the newsroom. It's amazing. All these Michigan people. I mean, for the listener at home, you might think I'm exaggerating, but I think there are 13,000 University of Michigan graduates in the Journal newsroom. It's amazing. And it's in the sports department. It's me and Oshinsky, Matt Oshinsky, an editor who went to the University of Wisconsin. And then we got Turlip, investigative reporter Sharon Turlip, MSU, Sparty. And then we got some goofballs from Duke. But it's all Michigan people. It's all Michigan
it
people.
It is. It is.
Ugh. Well, I don't know who I'm rooting for. Still got to figure that one out.
Oh, come on with that. You're not – you. I know you love Jim Harbaugh.
I enjoy Jim Harbaugh immensely. But, you know, going to Michigan, it's like going to the Death Star. I don't have this whole, like, oh, sad Michigan, I'm happy for them vibe. You know, years at Wisconsin, Michigan was like the Death Star. And I don't adhere at all to the notion that Michigan somehow is some sort of, like, polite comeback story.
Yeah, I hear that. It's a little arrogant to think, oh, when Michigan's, you know, good, it's good for the sport. I sense how I'm obnoxious.
You know,
that must sound to most
can
other
I give you some
schools.
Real talk. At University of Wisconsin, we think of Michigan as an East Coast school. It's an East Coast school, basically.
Well, we are in the Eastern time zone.
But we're champions of the West. How can that be?
Nah, I don't get this division thing. And all I know what's going to happen is Wisconsin beat Nebraska next week, and it what's sure to happen is that we're going to get to the West, we're going to win the West, and then we're going to lose 79-9 to somebody, whether that's Michigan State, Ohio State, or Michigan, that would just be brutal. Rachel, you are here for another reason, which is that you had a big story in the Wall Street Journal. You have a big story in the Wall Street Journal about bicycling, always a hot topic,
mm-hmm.
and helmets, a hotter topic, if it's possible. And the idea that helmets, contrary to popular belief, that helmets and especially the idea of helmet laws might not actually be in the best interest of the cycling community. And can you explain a little bit on that?
Yes, this is basically the rule of unintended consequences. And the idea is that mandatory helmet laws, especially the all ages ones for, you know, adults as well as kids, create these ripple effects. They tend to make people more fearful of cycling than maybe they should be. And that consequently reduces ridership. And there's some more research now saying that essentially there's strength in numbers, that the more people there are cycling in an area, the fewer crashes there are, which is totally counterintuitive. But the idea is that essentially drivers become more accustomed to seeing cyclists on the road. They slow down, they avoid them more. And so there is some strength in numbers. And a lot of cycling advocates don't want anything that will interfere with that. And they say that bike helmet laws do.
But what you are saying, to be very clear for, you know, my fellow brethren in the cycling community, you are not saying don't wear a helmet.
No, I'm not saying that. We make sure to be clear about that in the story, despite my email inbox. This is not anti-helmet.
Right.
Yes.
You're not contesting the idea that a helmet versus a no helmet is a preferable position.
That is correct. That is correct. We're actually asking people to think for themselves. And, you know, there are circumstances, I'm sure you've been in some of them yourself, Jason, where you're cycling on a path, there's no one else around, it's a beautiful sunny day, you're going 4 miles an hour and you're going four blocks. Do you really need to put on a helmet in that context? Maybe not.
I would say, I mean, I'll tell you personally, you know, I have put my head down. You know, I used to be a terrible, terrible amateur bike racer, and I've put my head down in competitive situations and non-competitive situations, and I will never ride a bike without a helmet just because of that. Mm-hmm. And like the idea of like feeling completely comfortable and at ease without a helmet, it's just not for me. But I completely support anybody else's right to not do it if they don't want to do it, not in competitive cycling. But what we are talking about, though, is just sort of incentivizing riding for people. And what's strange, and you get into a little bit in the story, is that there's this belief among the cycling community that helmet laws are actually a weapon to sort of decrease cycling among politicians, that they're sort of trying to disincentivize it for people. And, you know, the next thing they want to do is licensing for cyclists and all this.
Yeah. I think first of all, I have to say at the extreme ends of this argument, there are some black helicopters, and there's a lot of, you know, speculation about the motivations of each side.
Jeff, are you a helmet guy?
First of all, I don't generally ride a bicycle ever. I do support helmets. For instance, I've skied with a helmet. I think that's I don't understand people who don't ski with a helmet, to be honest.
But it's not mandatory.
No, it's not mandatory. I'm sort of shocked it isn't.
Considering, do you think it should be
mandatory? Yeah, skiing is very dangerous.
I've fallen on a bike, and it's usually a sort of a leg wound situation. Whereas if you fall on a ski slope really bad, that's you're flipping over on your head and that type of thing. But not to get off topic. Am I a helmet guy? I try to get my daughter to wear one.
Yeah.
She refuses.
Really?
Yeah.
You're not making her do it.
Well, I don't even know what to do because I'll say to her, if you don't wear a helmet, you can't ride a scooter. And she goes, okay, I won't ride a scooter.
And actually, that is one of the dangers. There are some public health officials who say this is what's happened in Australia, that helmet laws there have decreased ridership significantly.
Yeah.
And consequently, you know, there's more Australia's catching up to us in obesity and all kinds of unintended consequences.
So tell me what your email is like right now, Rachel.
I have everything from essentially people who say we shouldn't be required to wear helmets at all, not kids, not, you know, you shouldn't wear a helmet, to people who think it's irresponsible to even raise the question, basically.
Right.
That, you know, how dare you even suggest that anybody shouldn't wear a helmet in any context.
This is kind of the sweet spot of what makes a great story for the journal, I think, though. It's like anytime you can get into personal activity crossing with personal liberty,
yes,
it's just, you know, you're right, you know, that is the sweet spot, right?
I will say I have driven a car in New York City, and I've seen, I'm definitely more aware of cyclists without helmets. Like, they make me nervous at driving an automobile.
Yeah.
Whereas I also feel like in general New Yorkers on bicycles, I don't know if this applies to you, Jason, don't seem very conscious of the cars. Like, they don't really appreciate this giant moving vehicle made of heavy steel that's right next to them and could kill them instantly?
That's probably true. I do feel like, you know, to support what Rachel's saying, like, strength in numbers, I think, is the most essential part of cycling in urban areas. The idea that more people are doing it increases, you know, other people doing it, of course, but also I think increases rule abeyance. You know, when I started riding a bike in New York City, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was a lawless activity in a lawless town. And, yeah, you know, I ran every red light. Nowadays, you come to a red light, say you're on, you know, 14th Street, you'll get there, especially, you know, commuting parts of the day. There are 13, 14, 15 cyclists all stopping at the red light. Am I going to plow through that? No, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to stop. I'm going to sort of feel the pressure of that group experience. And I think that very much speaks to the idea of strength in numbers and also safety. I feel a lot safer riding down a road system with a handful of people out there. I get, you know, the other thing that's sort of concurrent to all this conversation about cycling and commuting is freaking texting and driving. And the thing that wipes out a cyclist is that just momentary lapse of attention where someone, for whatever reason, gets distracted and they just, you know, all it takes is just 4 feet lurching to the right and, you know, terrible, terrible things can happen. So that's in the back of my mind as much as anything. I saw this incredible product. I don't know if you've seen that now, that there are kind of rear sensors for cycles, for bicycles, where so you have your sort of helmet, I mean, front-mounted device, whether it's like a Garmin or something like that, that it can detect activity behind you and kind of give you a notification that there's a car or a steaming freight engine heading your way. I support, anything that encourages safe cycling, I encourage. If you don't have a helmet, get a helmet. If you don't have lights for your bike, get lights for your bike. I want a score from you, Rachel, for Michigan, Michigan State. You said squeaker.
Ooh, yeah.
Give me a score.
Let's say 24-21.
24-24. That's a rather high-scoring affair.
Yeah, I think so.
24-10, Michigan.
Oh, I thought you were going to do the Price is Right thing where you're just going to like...
24-19.
Well, listen, Rachel, you've been a wonderful guest. Guest number two here on the Free For All. And listen, we made a little bit of history today. Please subscribe to the WSJ podcast system. Please subscribe to the Free For All. We're going to be back here every week with fascinating stories from the Wall Street Journal. Not always sports stories. Things far afield. Special guests. Comedians. Small pets. The Free For All. It is what it is. The Free For All. And I guess now the...
Mainly small pets.
Mainly small pets and reptiles. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Free For All.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.